Whenever I have papers in front of me, you might know it's going to be a little bit longer. I don't know, something like that. On August 17th, the President of the United States of America visited a small synagogue. He was well received and thanked by the rabbi and the congregation for the visit of support, particularly in that it sent a strong message to their neighbors about the values of this American society with regard to religious liberty and the importance of not just tolerance, but freedom. The president wrote a letter quoting back to the rabbi what the rabbi had said in the rabbi's own words. No small compliment, by the way. And the president wrote, "The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed at the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support." There are a lot of confused faces here, so by now it's pretty clear that I'm not speaking of a recent visit by a president to a synagogue or of the current president of the United States. Rather, I am speaking of something that goes back quite a ways further. I'll reveal it in a moment. This past week has been so traumatic, so filled with rhetoric and vitriol, with blame and anger. I'm choosing specifically not to directly speak about the horrific events in Charlottesville last Shabbat, or the responses to the violence, nor the specific response of President Trump. There's much to say, but I don't really see it as my purpose this Shabbat. I'll be more than happy to talk privately with any of you about my opinions and my thoughts on these events. I will say, though, that the most harrowing reporting for me, personally, as your rabbi, was the letter that was written by the president of Congregation Beth Israel in Charlottesville, Virginia. In the letter, he describes the experience of what it was to worship at their shul last Shabbat morning as the forces of demonic Nazi hate marshaled around their neighborhood, and in point of fact, directly in front of their synagogue, shouting, "There's the synagogue, Sieg Heil," and displaying their semi-automatic rifles. If you've not read this account, please take the time to do so. It can be found on the reformjudaism.org blog. It is truly harrowing. But back to that original letter that I quoted. Students of American history, and I know there are some of you here right now, may recognize the words. They were written by our first president, George Washington, after his August 17th, 1790 visit to Newport, Rhode Island, including the synagogue Yeshuat Yisrael, now known as the Turo Synagogue, and in response to their rabbi, Moses Satius. On this visit, he was joined by his Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, among others. In the George Washington papers, his letter to the Jews of Newport is dated August 18, 1790, though it wasn't delivered until August 21st, but still the confluence of dates is of note. As we sit here in this synagogue, 227 years to the day after President Washington wrote these words. And I hope you'll bear with me for a moment. I'm going to read, it is not a very long letter, but I want to read the full letter, and I will tell you, I promise you, every single word is worth it. President Washington wrote, "Gentlemen," that's of note, by the way, too. "Gentlemen, while I received with much satisfaction your address, replete with expressions of esteem, I rejoice in the opportunity of assuring you that I shall always retain grateful remembrances of the cordial welcome I experienced on my visit to Newport from all classes of citizens. The reflection on the days of difficulty and danger which are past is rendered the more sweet from a consciousness that they are succeeded by days of uncommon prosperity and security. If we have wisdom to make the best use of the advantages with which we are now favored, we cannot fail, under the just administration of a good government, to become a great and happy people. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. all possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of as if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. This is my favorite part of the letter. It would be inconsistent with the frankness of my character not to avow that I am pleased with your favorable opinion of my administration and fervent wishes for my felicity. He concludes, may the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness upon our paths and make us all in our several vocations useful here and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy. G. Washington. Just G. You know, I think he probably figured they would figure out which G. Washington he was. Now, there are several other letters that Washington wrote, both before and after this, to the Jewish communities that were in America at the time. However, it is generally accepted that this particular letter was of singular importance in Washington's relationship with the Jewish community in America, and even more importantly, on the shaping of the very concept of religious freedom writ large in American society. Washington quotes back to Rabbi Moses Seixas the words of his own eloquent address to the President of the United States on the occasion of his visit to Newport. This is what Moses Seixas read aloud to the President, a selection from his letter. Rabbi Seixas writes, deprived as we heretofore have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens, we now, with a deep sense of gratitude to the Almighty, disposer of all events, behold a government erected by the majesty of the people, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming every one of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts in the great governmental machine. The specific words that Washington chose to incorporate into his letter, from Seixas' letter, have come to symbolize the very concept of what religious freedom means in the United States. A government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance. These are etched in my brain for sure. In so many ways, the United States of America was meant to be a different country than any that had come before. And in so many ways, that has been the case. The very idea that Jews would be full citizens, regardless of their religion, was revolutionary. Jewish emancipation was a topic of intense debate throughout Europe in 1790. And it would only be the following year that the Jews of France, through the Napoleonic Sanhedrin, would secure a limited emancipation for the Jews of France, but really only kind of limited. But Seixas was not necessarily referring to the oppression and discrimination that Jews had experienced in Europe when he notes, deprived as we heretofore have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens. In fact, one of the most prominent members of the Newport Synagogue, an individual who had been buried just 8 years prior, could have been animating his pen. Aaron Lopez was an honored member of the community, one of the most important and generous benefactors of the synagogue, as well as numerous of the communal institutions that he helped to build in Newport. In the early 1760s, he and Isaac Eliezer petitioned for naturalization in Rhode Island and were denied despite multiple court appeals, even to the Superior Court of Rhode Island. Aaron Lopez was the wealthiest individual in Newport, a merchant and trader. He was born and raised in Portugal in a converso family. That is, outwardly, they practiced Catholicism. Secretly, inwardly, they observed their Judaism. He followed his older brother to the colonies, and he prospered tremendously in Newport. Extremely civically involved, deeply philanthropic, he was the very picture of success. And yet, court after court denied his naturalization. The closest that he and Elizer came in Rhode Island was a lower court that deemed that Lopez and Elizer could take an oath of citizenship, after which they would be granted some rights, but that they would not have the right to vote nor the right to hold office. Ultimately, Lopez briefly left Rhode Island to pursue citizenship in Massachusetts. And as far as most historians know, he's believed to have been the first Jew to become an actual citizen of Massachusetts. But he returned to Rhode Island, and he was buried in the cemetery directly behind Rabbi Sachs when he uttered those words. As a Jew, he was not deemed worthy of full citizenship. It wasn't until 1776, when our great nation became the first nation to fully emancipate its Jews. When Washington visited Newport, the First Amendment, think about this, the First Amendment was still well over a year from being adopted. So religious freedom as an American ideal was still taking shape, which is why, as beautiful as the phrase, to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance is, it's actually a different part of Washington's letter that calls for specific attention. Something that you have to kind of read closely. He expands on Sachs's notion of giving thanks for the liberty and freedoms that the United States had given to Jews, granting them citizenship and protection. Indeed, Washington actually responds that the key here is no longer toleration or indulgence. What he writes is so beautiful. He says, "We are not one class of people deeming another lower class worthy, but rather," Washington affirms, "that these rights are inherent natural rights." This is an important shift. Sachs is grateful to the dominant Christian society for the freedoms that Jews are experiencing. Washington responds that it is not a factor of religious tolerance, but rather rights that are, as the Declaration of Independence would phrase it, self-evident. Jews, really all people, are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And ever since that day in 1776, our nation has been moving toward the realization of these aspirations, which is why I refuse to despair after the events of last weekend in Charlottesville, and why I refuse to cede the notion of what our country is and who we aim to be to those who would embolden hate, encourage division, and flame the fires of ancient violence. We, as a Jewish community, have known real discrimination and persecution. And seeing the swastika and hearing the chants are a reminder of a deep transgenerational pain. And it's the reason why we've historically stood with every community that has sought to expand the definition of who is deserving of the great protections that our nation has offered to us over the years. And it's why we will continue to stand together with our allies in claiming and assuring the self-evident promises of America. We as Jews, we will stand together with communities of color. We will stand together with immigrants. We will stand together with the LGBTQ+ community. We will stand with our Muslim neighbors, we will stand with Native Americans, we will stand with the poor, with women, with the disabled, and we will stand with anyone that is being discriminated against. And we will stand up for ourselves whenever and wherever we need to. We will stand on the side of right, and that will always put us in good company. A final note. It's not lost on me that part of the rhetoric over this past week about the controversies over Confederate, or in some cases Jim Crow and later statues, has led to a comparison. The logic is as follows. Washington was a slave owner. Do we take down his statue now? Jefferson was a slave owner. Is his image no longer tolerated? Having noted that it was both Washington and Jefferson who heard the words of Rabbi Sachs, I reject the comparison to statues that were often specifically intended to send a direct message to those who opposed slavery, saying, "We don't forget and we don't accept the outcome of the Civil War." Those statues are meant to send that message in a very direct and threatening way. In point of fact, I taught a little bit about that philanthropist, Aaron Lopez, an earlier Jewish resident of Newport. He was, in fact, a trader who made his initial fortune on candles made from whale oil. But the larger portion of his fortune came directly from trade of African slaves. And he was one of the most active slave traders of New England in his day. A Jew, a philanthropist, a pillar of the community, and a slave trader. There's no sanitizing of that record. Does this mean that we erase him from our record books and our histories? It's unwise to do so. But we need to be honest about a person's history. The Torah portion from this Shabbat, Re'eh, contains repeated reference to slavery as a natural and expected aspect of society. Should we erase these sections of Torah that make us uncomfortable? No. But neither should we allow them to sit unchallenged. The very section of Torah that I read was meant to make people a little bit uncomfortable. Smash their idols, obliterate their gods, drive them from the land. It was meant to make us uncomfortable, but it is Torah. I know of virtually no rabbis today across any of the streams of Judaism who would defend the institution of slavery, citing the Torah as a pretext for its enforcement. For some, we rationalize through textual commentary the ways in which slavery was acceptable then, but it is no more in our own day. For those of us, like me, in the progressive movements, we can point out that the very idea of slavery is in the Torah, and that that reveals a human flaw in the development of societies. And we can acknowledge that we move forward with more enlightened ideas. The Torah comes to us as an inspiration from God, but it often, and in the case of slavery, it reveals the flawed and unholy hands of man. As a nation, we've tried to move forward, never back, on the expansion of the fair treatment of all human beings. This is the America that I believe in. And I hear traces of it in the conclusion of Washington's letter to the Newport Jewish community, with which I'll end as a prayer. Washington writes, "May the children of the stock of Abraham, who dwell in this land, continue to merit and enjoy the good will of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness upon our paths, and make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy. May we all sit under vine and fig tree, with none to make us afraid. May we all know light and happiness, justice and peace. Wish you all Shabbat Shalom." And it's a pleasure to call on Donna Kasoff, the president of our congregation, for a few words and perhaps, maybe, quotes from her favorite president of the United States. I have to tee you up for something, right?